Good morning. Welcome to the Project on Military and Diplomatic History at CSIS event series. For those of you who haven't been here before, I'll just give you a little bit of background. I'm Mark Moyer, the director of the program. We promote history that has that provides a window onto contemporary national security affairs and controversies. In a time when policy-relevant history is under siege in the academy and under mothballs in the policy community, we seek to bring historians to D.C. to interact with the policy world. It's one of the tendencies, I think, from spending too much time in D.C. is you forget how much knowledge resides outside of the Beltway. And we are of the view that, particularly in the historical community, there's a lot of knowledge in historians who are spread out across the country and the world. And so this program, which just started here at CSIS a few months ago, is intended to bring the historians here to D.C. to talk on policy-relevant subjects. And we hope not only to enlighten you on this subject today to some extent, but also to promote a longer-term interest in history and to forge ties with historians. So I encouraged our speaker to bring lots of business cards so that you can trade with him after we are done today and hopefully continue the discussion for years to come. Going to mention a few of our other upcoming events. We've got a busy November. On November 8th, Natalie Nguyen will be speaking about America's South Vietnamese allies. On November 9th, on the 75th anniversary of the invasion of North Africa, we will have Meredith Hinley. November 13th, we will feature Victor Davis Hanson and his new book on World War II. November 17th, we have Serhii Plokhii talking about his new book on the history of Russia. And if you're not already on our mailing list, you can sign up on our website. Now, you may have heard that some people allegedly tried to interfere with America's elections last year. We have, in fact, two Senate committees, a House committee, and an independent counsel who are now looking into the matter. Controversy has already cost several people their jobs, senior jobs in the U.S. government, and by some reckonings, it changed the outcome of the election. The American public has been barraged with claims from many leading public figures from both political parties that the United States was victimized by an unprecedented interference in our elections. But having been in this business for some time now, I would caution you that whenever you hear the word unprecedented, that you first ask the question, is it really unprecedented? So the more you study history, the more I think you come towards the view that there really is nothing new under the sun. And after hearing about all this chatter of unprecedented interference, I decided to look for historians who had actually studied the interference of elections as a historical matter. It didn't take long to find several of them. But out of those, I selected the one who I think can do the most to help Washington and the world more generally understand this subject. Now, for some people, the history of past electoral shenanigans may be satisfaction enough. It's always good fun to point out the historical ignorance of politicians and journalists. And those who wish to find fault with the U.S. government or to deplore the hypocrisy of great powers, it's easy to revel in revelations that the U.S. government has itself interfered with the elections of other countries. But we set up today's event for a different purpose, which is to enhance our understanding and our ability to address a problem that's likely going to be with us for decades to come. So I think given the perceived successes of the meddling of 2016 and the difficulties that are inherent in imposing penalties on the perpetrators, it seems all but certain that the various actors will seek to replicate this success in future years. So how can history enable the United States and its allies to contend with future acts of interference in elections? Well, that is the question that we have asked today's speaker to answer, and I will provide a few words of introduction. Dr. Calder Walton is currently at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, where he holds the Ernest May Fellowship, and that happens to be of particular interest to me since Ernest May was my mentor once upon a time. It's also of broader interest to this program since Ernest May remains one of the seminal thinkers on the use of history in policy decisions. And if you haven't already read his 1986 book, Thinking in Time, co-authored with Richard Neustadt, I strongly encourage you to do so. Dr. Walton earned his PhD in history at Cambridge under the supervision of Christopher Andrew, who happened to be my PhD supervisor back in the day as well. That's also a coincidence. We'd actually never met until earlier this year at the ISA annual meeting, where his lively historical presentation was a delightful contrast to a lot of the dreary social science that was going on there. At Cambridge, Dr. Walton was the lead researcher on Professor Andrew's authorized history of the British Secret Service, British Security Service, MI5. He's also a qualified English barrister, which in American parlance is an attorney, and has worked on several high-profile litigation cases involving security issues. In 2013, he published the book British Intelligence, The Cold War and the Twilight of Empire, which won the Longman History Today Book of the Year Award. And he's currently working on a book about the rise and fall of intelligence superpowers from the 20th century's world wars to cyber warfare today. And I'd ask, before we begin, please silence your cell phones, pagers, Fitbits, and other electronic devices. But those who are technologically inclined can follow this conversation on Twitter. And those who are watching us remotely, you can tweet questions if you have them to @CSISPMDH. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Calder Walton.
Well, first of all, I should say thank you very much, Mark, for the kind introduction. It's really a pleasure to be here. If anyone's going to be starting to tweet questions to me, I'd ask these probably should come from a real-life human being, not a bot that we read about in the news today. Mark's project, it's great to be here and to be, I hope, continued affiliations with Mark's new project. As Mark had just said, it's certainly an unfashionable subject at the moment. There seems to be a mothballing of diplomatic and military history. At the Kennedy School, we're launching a similar project, the Applied History Project. So I hope that between there and here, there are a few beacons of light in an otherwise dark diplomatic and military history atmosphere. As Mark said, what I really want to talk about today is try to bring some historical perspective to the what we read about in the news today with the interference by Russia in the 2016 presidential election, which seems to be attracting headlines every single day. Let's try to make sure this works. That does work. Every single day, there seems to be another revelation about ways in which Russia interfered in the election, from the so-called dirty dossier on Trump to information that was leaked to WikiLeaks. Just 2 weeks ago, Hillary Clinton in the UK, promoting her book, went so far as to say what a lot of people have been saying in private, which is WikiLeaks was essentially functioning as a subsidiary of the Russian intelligence services in leaking this material. And these revelations, a lot of them in the news today, have been met with shock and surprise. But as Mark was alluding to earlier, I think this is wrong. What is surprising is that it actually caused any surprise at all. There's actually a long history of Moscow directing its intelligence services to interfere in US presidential elections. And I would argue that it's impossible to understand what we read about today without understanding the past. And I think that picking up on what Mark said again at the, in the introduction, a lot of this is addressed in an ahistorical manner. And a lot of the journalists reporting this don't seem to know the history. I'm not going to level too much at the journalists. I'd actually be much more hard on my own profession, historians, here. Despite the avalanche of records that are now available in archives in both the US and the UK and in other countries, Historians are persisting to neglect the role of intelligence in their writing. If you go online, and you can do so right after this talk or even during the talk, and go to the online database JSTOR, you will find that less than 1% of all entries in a full search term on the Cold War links anything to do with a National Security Agency, NSA. That's to say, 99% of all entries on JSTOR do not expressly recognize that the NSA played any role in the Cold War. John Lewis's Gaddis's book, phenomenal and otherwise outstanding book, doesn't mention GCHQ, Britain's Signals Intelligence Agency, once. We're supposed to believe, if you look at the history of the Second World War, that yes, there were code breakers operating in the Second World War, but in the post-war years, when the Cold War set in, according to these studies, they stopped work. Now, clearly something's not right here. Either 99% of the JSTOR entries are wrong, or the historians are wrong. I would argue quite strongly that it's the latter. So why does this matter, other than correcting the historical record? Well, I think there's a straightforward policy implications here. Graduates and undergraduates, and even those that are curious in history, reading these historical, even the most recently published books, are actually left with misunderstandings and otherwise omissions about the role of intelligence that they simply do not understand because they can't, because they're not in the books, the historical background about the use and abuse of intelligence. The story of the Russian interference in the 2016 election, I'm sure, is well known to people in this room, in this city of all places. Russian hackers apparently hacked into the DNC email account of the chairman, Democratic chairman John Podesta, and then set up a series of cover personas, including the mysterious Guccifer 2.0, that's to say the Romanian hacker who can't speak Romanian, and leaked it the data publicly on WikiLeaks. The 2016 January 2017, before Trump was elected, DNI assessment, which I got up there, puts it very bluntly. Quote, "We assess with high confidence Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an influence campaign in 2016 aimed at the US presidential election. Russia's goals were to undermine public faith in the US democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. We further assess Putin and the Russian government developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump," end of quote. Anyone who's familiar with the reports written by the US and British intelligence communities will be struck that the phrase high degree of confidence is striking. And when we look at it historically, we'll find that the same things that they discuss in this report, there are the same strategic aims that Russia, the Soviet Union had in the past, undermining public faith in the US democratic process. As I said, long history of Russian, what's called active measures. In the West, we might call this covert action. That's to say, not just gathering intelligence on opponents and other regimes, but actually trying to influence the affairs of other countries. Traditionally, we'd think of this, at least in the Western context, in terms of coups and regime changes. But in fact, I think this actually is better understood by looking at it as a sort of a spectrum of influence operations, from propaganda on the one hand, perhaps attributable or non-attributable to a government in question that's disseminating the propaganda, through to what's called disinformation, forgeries and tricks to help inculcate conspiracy theories. And then through to actually gathering compromising material, perhaps on politicians, media manipulation, and then outright what's called, at least in the KGB vernacular, special action involving various degrees of violence, including at the most extreme assassinations. Russia was certainly the past master of this from the Bolshevik Revolution onwards. And I think it's in this context that we need to understand what we read about in terms of the so-called Steele dossier, the dossier written by a former MI6 SIS officer, including salacious details, for those who don't know why it's called the PP dossier or, quote, Wettergate. I'll leave it to you to Google and find out afterwards. Stories about sexual escapades aside, the allegation in this dossier is that the SVR today has compromising material on Trump, which they might be able to use to blackmail him in a kind of Manchurian candidate style phenomenon. Who knows if these are true? This is something that Robert Mueller there is going to presumably be looking into. But what we can say with certainty that there's a long tradition of Russia's intelligences today, their predecessors, doing exactly this against their Western opponents. The first head of station, CIA head of station in Moscow, Edward Elias Smith, was compromised when he was seduced by a Russian maid who was inevitably in the pay of the KGB, who then tried to use photographs of their liaison to blackmail him. He went to the Russian, to the American ambassador at the time, admitted this, and was dispatched back to Washington. There's actually a staggering number of US officials in the Moscow embassy in the mid-1950s who came forward saying about that they were attempted to be the victims of blackmail by KGB, 12 in total. It didn't always work. In one striking example, the Stasi, the East German security service, attempted to blackmail, again through a sexual liaison and photographs, an Italian politician. The Italian politician said, well, this is great, actually. Can I have some photographs of those? I'd really like to show them. So it didn't always work, but this is a long, long-standing technique. The so-called active measures of the KGB in the Soviet, under the Soviet times was carried out by Service A within the Foreign Intelligence Directorate. One former KGB officer, Oleg Kalugin, described this as, quote, the heart and the soul of Soviet intelligence. Why have we got a picture of a building in the bottom right there? That's what we're reading about further today in terms of how active measures, covert action, is moving from the physical world into the cyber domain. This is the Russian Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, a staff of 90 members, in which they had social media accounts of about 6 million people in total for a mere $120,000. This was a cheap, effective way of fostering discontent. Just this week, various news outlets, including BuzzFeed, have revealed that this Russian troll factory, essentially, was able to tap into social discontent within the US, promoting fake accounts linked to real, genuine groups in the US. They set up a fake account called Black Lives US, which was linked to Black Lives Matter. And in one case I know about that I've read, were able to foster a physical protest. So again, this links back to what we said earlier in terms of the DNI report about inculcating public distrust in the US. Mark's kindly sort of said already a little bit about my research. So just to say something that he didn't mention, my current book is on superpowers and intelligence, the history of that. I'm also just been appointed the general editor and contributor of a three-volume Cambridge History of Intelligence that will explore the role of intelligence from the ancient world all the way to the present day. This is a daunting task. It's a 4 to 5 year project, but I'm excited to be part of it. As Mark also mentioned, I was a research assistant on Chris Andrews' authorized history of MI5, which involved exciting research part-time in Thames House in MI5's headquarters for 6 years. Oh, and there's some shameless bit of self-promotion with my first book there as well. There's never been a better time to study intelligence history for those who are interested in it. Just last year, this year actually, the CIA has made available I think, 12 million pages of its declassified records that were previously only available in a physically awkward corner of the National Archives in College Park. Now you don't even need to leave your room to do this research. There's a staggering number of now declassified British intelligence records at the National Archives in London and the presidential archives in various parts of the country. They're crying out to be done. The exciting thing about this project, this area of research, isn't just that we now have access, as never before, to Western intelligence documents. We also have access to some staggering number of Soviet intelligence documents, no more so than the extraordinary archive by a former senior KGB archivist, Vasily Matrokhin, which was publicly made available for the first time 2 years ago, now in Churchill College, Cambridge. It's been said, and I think it's accurate, that there's now two places in the world where you can study these kind of KGB records. One's in the headquarters of the SVR, and the other's in Churchill College, Cambridge. I think it's reasonably safe to say it's easier to get to Churchill College, Cambridge than it is to the headquarters of the SVR. This source, as the FBI said, gave them the most complete and extensive intelligence ever received from any source. I would encourage anyone that's interested and wants to take this subject seriously to get a plane ticket to Churchill College, Cambridge, and to have a look at what's in there. Background to Russia's active measures that we read about today. As I mentioned at the outset, there's a long history of the Kremlin doing anything it could to undermine confidence in the democratic process within the US against what was called then its main adversary, the United States. Prevent politicians coming to power that were adverse to the Soviet Union, or prevent them winning elections, or if they were in power, minimizing their impact. The active measures unit of the KGB, Service A, had about 15,000 officers at its height. They involved planting stories and sponsoring defectors to publicize accounts of CIA dirty work, forgeries linking, for example, the Ku Klux Klan to the sent to the Olympic committees of various African countries. One of the most staggering conspiracy theories that they promulgated was that the AIDS virus was manufactured by the US government. And of course, there was one event more than any that was fertile ground for conspiracy theories, which was the assassination of JFK, which the KGB did their utmost to try to inculcate various conspiracies about, including forging documents from Lee Harvey Oswald. In the 1960s, it was the veteran anti-communist Richard Nixon who was the focus of particular concern by the KGB. The KGB offered to subsidize secretly the election campaign of his unsuccessful Democratic opponent, Hubert Humphrey. It didn't work. He said, thank you very much, but I'll do it myself. And then, as we know, once in power, Nixon was actually far less antagonistic towards the Soviet Union than Moscow was fearing. But by the 1980s, there was one US politician more than anyone else that inspired fear and loathing in Moscow, and that was, of course, Ronald Reagan. In April 1982, the KGB chairman issued a series of directives in which he instructed all KGB officers, whatever their department, whatever their line, to participate in active measures. In February 1983, it was the prospect of a Reagan second term which caused the KGB headquarters, the center, to issue instructions to its three residencies in the US to do anything that they could to prevent the election of Reagan in the forthcoming election in November 1984. They were instructed to cultivate agents in either political party, the Democrats or the Republicans, on the understanding that absolutely any candidate in the election would be better than Reagan. They attempted to gather compromising material, compromat on Reagan. All they could find was some drinking about his father. It was an unsuccessful attempt and not the kind of thing that that compromat was made of. Soviet intelligence attempted to infiltrate the headquarters, as I said, of the DNC, and popularizing some slogans that could be used before the election campaign. The slogans being "Reagan means war," and various leaked stories to the press that the president was a corrupt civil servant of the military-industrial complex. All of this had absolutely no effect. Reagan won in a landslide victory, I think winning 49 of the 50 states. So this was a failed operation to influence a US presidential election. They didn't create a kind of Manchurian candidate that they perhaps were dreaming of. But that's not to say that they didn't learn from their mistakes. Particularly so, a young KGB officer who was then being schooled at the Andropov Institute in active measures, who later said that he learned about past mistakes and reapplied them to the domestic front. That was Vladimir Putin, who in a collection of interviews said that he applied techniques that he'd learned about at the time in the early 1980s in the Andropov Institute to hijacking events domestically. It seems fair to say that the KGB then turned more attention to sowing seeds of distrust within the US public. As I said, AIDS conspiracies, and in particular about the JFK assassination. Internal notes in the Matrokhin archive say that I think reasonably that the KGB could say that more people domestically in the US believed one of their conspiracy theories about the JFK assassination than they did the US government's own inquiry, the Warren Commission. At this point, you're probably thinking this is something peculiar to Russia, and I would argue strongly against that. There's actually the idea of interfering in an election through forgeries goes back a long time, all the way to the early 1920s, at which point British codebreakers had intercepted a series of instructions from the Communist International movement to the local domestic Communist Party, the Communist Party of Great Britain. The problem was that these intercepts were polluted with forgeries. And this picture there is a headline that was produced 4 days before the election in 1924. It was a forgery, and it was the so-called Zinoviev telegram, in which the Russian foreign minister allegedly was asking the local Communist Party in Britain, the CPGB, to carry out what was known as agitation propaganda, agitprop, within the British Armed Forces. It was leaked to the Daily Mail, and in October, just days before the election, was a bombshell. The first ever British Labour administration fell. Most historians agree to say that this wasn't definitely the cause of the fall of the Ramsay MacDonald's government, but it certainly didn't help. There's been an enormous literature on where this forgery came from. Was MI6 and MI5, were they involved in some way? Seems safe to say there may have been elements within MI5 and MI6 that were involved in leaking it. The latest research, and I'd point you in the direction of the former official historian of the British Foreign Office, Jill Bennett, has concluded that the forgery was written by not Soviet intelligence officers, but by white Russians, anti-Bolshevik groups in Eastern Europe. Can talk more about this in questions afterwards. And it's certainly not just in Britain where this happens. There's a long history of the US interfering in foreign elections. One of the first acts of the CIA after it was founded in 1947 was to carry out a covert action program in the Italian elections in 1948. The aim was to fend off equally active Soviet interference in those elections, support moderates, the Italian Christian Democratic Party, and undermine by any ways they could the local Italian Communist Party. The newly established CIA used $10 million of funds captured from the Nazi loot, to channel into moderate parties, including to the election campaign of the Italian Prime Minister then, De Gasperi. Picture of him there. The influence operations the CIA carried out in Italy involved a broad spectrum of operations, from propaganda, posters, pamphlets, and stories put up in Italian cities against communists, through to straightforward disinformation, forgeries implicating socialist candidates with the Communist Party. It's difficult to know the exact impact that this had on the election, but we do know that the Christian Democrats, the people that the CIA wanted to win, won 307 of the 574 seats. Truman sent his personal thanks to the CIA on the day that the victory was announced, and I would argue that this instilled a belief within CIA of the benefits of covert action, a belief that persisted for a long time to come. But again, it's not just the US that's involved in this kind of thing. One of the most extraordinary documents I found really in all of my research was declassified a year ago from the Permanent Undersecretary of the Foreign Office, British Foreign Office, in which this is unusual for a number of reasons. Unusual in that we don't get very many MI6, SIS documents declassified publicly, and we also don't get documents that involve these kind of things. This essentially is a policy recommendation from MI6 in 1948 to the Foreign Office about how it recommends conducting a covert war against the Soviet Union. I don't know if the resolution has come out that well, but it involved things like framing of Soviet diplomats with the aim of their removal and liquidation, bribery and blackmail, distribution of forged documents, kidnapping of high-ranking individuals to give the appearance of defection, and then most ominously at the end of the list, liquidation of selected individuals. It's important to say that we don't know whether this was just a wish list, a shopping list of what could happen that MI6 was dreaming up at the time, and to what extent they were actually carried out. But they certainly were carried out both by the US and the UK in various places around the world. People know a lot, and it's a whole tranche of records have been declassified just earlier this year on the coup instigated by MI6 and the CIA in Iran in 1953. Less known, and I'm not in this talk so much interested in coups as such as to actual sort of covert manipulation of elections. Less, and on that note, I think much more relevant is the case of British Guyana, where the leader there in the middle, Chetty Jagan, British Guyana being a British colony, British territory in South America, the leader there was a Marxist, and there were big questions about whether he was a communist or even a Soviet agent. Conspiring together, the British and the US attempted to redraw the election boundaries in Guyana so that he wouldn't win, but he kept winning, and he kept winning throughout the 1950s. In the end, the British handed over, in a sort of staggering way, covert action in British Guyana to CIA, who funded his opponent, Forbes Burnham. There's a picture of JFK meeting Chetty Jagan in the White House at the same time as he was plowing funds into his opponent, Forbes Burnham. So the British and the US have both been involved in manipulating foreign elections. But there's also a really ugly underbelly of this story as well, and that is British deception against its closest ally, the United States. I think anyone in from school days onwards knows about the Zimmerman telegram, which was one of the main factors of bringing the US into the First World War. This involved, as we probably all know, a letter from the German Foreign Minister Zimmermann to the Mexican government promising them lands in the southern US if they would join a war against the United States. This was actually a British deception operation in many ways. The telegram was sent via the US transatlantic cable, which the British were tapping. They intercepted this and then were confronted with a classic dilemma about how to expose this without letting, first of all, the Germans know, and second of all, the Americans know. the first decrypt to land on David Lloyd George's desk when he became British Prime Minister in 1916 wasn't a German decrypt or intercept, it was a US intercept. The British were comprehensively reading US diplomatic cables. The British dreamt up an elaborate deception ploy, leaking the telegram, the Zimmermann telegram, which is down there, to Woodrow Wilson, who had just in 1916 campaigned in his election on keeping America out of the war. And it was leaked. They suggested that it came from an agent, a human agent in the Mexican embassy. And this history, this episode, wasn't lost on the British 20 years later as the Second World War approached. Britain, fighting for its survival, desperately needing US support in any way possible. As has been written comprehensively, the first, or the leading British intelligence officer stationed in the US, William Stevenson, Bill Stevenson, was head of the British Security Coordination. The so-called, his codename, was the man called Intrepid. And he, Stevenson, played a leading role in setting up the wartime US intelligence community, the OSS, and then the post-war CIA. There's a picture of Bill Stevenson receiving a medal from William Donovan, I believe, Big Bill and Little Bill, as they were known. And during the war, Britain and the US started to share intelligence through BSC in an unprecedented way. And Britain and America would go on in the Cold War to have the special relationship with intelligence being at the heart of the so-called special relationship. But in that early period before America entered the war, there was an ugly underbelly, as I said, to this story. At the same time he was sharing intelligence, BSC was sharing intelligence with Roosevelt administration. He was also doing his best to minimize the impact of powerful groups in the US promoting US isolationism. In particular, the so-called America First Committee, led by the charismatic aviator and Nazi sympathizer Charles Lindbergh. BSC's efforts to minimize the impact of isolationists involved leaking pro-British reports to the press and involved, amazingly, the young Roald Dahl, who was stationed in BSC at the time and wrote a series of letters in the British press. They were, as in the First World War, Bletchley Park was also intercepting US diplomatic communications. As well as leaking stories to the press in the US with the aim of influencing public opinion, they were also, the forgery section of BSC, British Security Coordination, M section, set about fabricating a series of intelligence about Nazi designs for the Americas. One was a letter from allegedly from the Bolivian military attaché in Berlin, describing a Nazi dictatorship in Bolivia. It was set out with all of the correct watermarks and stamps. FDR there quoted this letter in one of his famous fireside chats, broadcast live on radio, in September 1941. It went even further in the following month, in October 1941, again broadcast live in his Navy Day address at the end of that month, in which he set out an imaginary Nazi master plan. Quote, "I have in my possession a secret map made in Germany by Hitler's government, by the planners of the New World Order there. It's a map of South America and part of Central America as Hitler proposes to reorganize it." Carries on. He's going to reorganize it into five vassal states, bringing the whole continent under their domination. This map makes clear the Nazi design not only against South America, but against the United States itself. End of quote. The problem was that this was a fabrication of British intelligence. There's the map there. It looks good, but it's nonsense. We can say with certainty that the centerpiece of FDR's most outspoken public attack on Nazi Germany before Pearl Harbor were British intelligence forgeries. I'd argue this is the original fake news. So where does this leave us today? Well, one of the take-home issues I'd like you to have is that it's not surprising that Russia's intelligence services today, which proudly see themselves as the heirs of the KGB, should be attempting to interfere with a US presidential election. This is particularly so given Putin's former KGB career. It's also been set out clearly within the Russian military doctrine by the Chief of General Staff Gerasimov, if I pronounced his name correctly, so-called hybrid warfare, in which military and non-military cyber activities would be combined. We saw this of Russia's annexation of the Crimea. The problem is that I think that what we're facing is an atmosphere in which disinformation is more amenable than any before. There have been conspiracy theories in the past. There have been attempts of disinformation. But for whatever reason, and then the reasons probably lie outside of historians' mere skills, society today seems to be much more willing to listen to these. And here are three examples that came out in the presidential election. That Denzel Washington was supporting Trump, completely false. That the Pope was supporting Trump, false. And then the Pizzagate conspiracy, which really took on an extraordinary turn. For those who don't know about it, we could talk about that after. So what do we do about this? What does history say? Are there any lessons? And in particular, what I'm interested in, and those of us in the program at the Kennedy School, what we're interested in is so-called applied history. What does this history say about for policy implications for today? One of the major lessons of the later Cold War, the whole history of the Cold War, is how important it is to combat propaganda or fake news given by countries that are attempting to stir up distrust domestically. You need look no further than the US Information Agency, which was highly successful in the Cold War at promoting ideas about American values and so on. And in particular, I draw your attention to the work of Britain's Information Research Department, IRD, which is one of the most secretive British agencies in the Cold War. It was a counter-information, counter-propaganda department set up in 1948 and lasted until the early 1980s. It was involved in distributing the works of famous authors like George Orwell behind the Iron Curtain, and, for example, issued a series of what were called background books on specific topics that were Russian disinformation or propaganda. Another particular, I think, particularly relevant agency to look at was the US Interagency Active Measures Working Group, set up, as I understand it, in the early 1980s. The group, the group's first counter disinformation effort against the Soviet Union took the form of various reports issued around the government about Russian active measures, forgeries. For example, those I mentioned earlier, forgeries sent apparently from the Ku Klux Klan to the Olympics, and also the AIDS virus. Conspiracy theory. A young Senator Joe Biden, in his interactions with the Interagency Active Measures Working Group, said that actually examining the forgeries that were being disseminated by the KGB, they were actually relatively easy to spot because of spelling mistakes and so on. But he did pose a question, which I think has echoes for today, which is what will happen if they actually stop being so incompetent? And I'd argue that where we are today with social media is exactly there. I'll leave with just some general thoughts. All major countries have undertaken influence operations in one way or another, active measures or covert action. But I'd argue that cyber now provides new opportunities for much older techniques. I'll leave that up in case anyone wants to. Another lesson is the value, as I was just mentioning, of agencies dealing with disinformation, IRD and the US Information Agency. The interconnectivity of the world today gives us a whole host of new problems. I'd argue that we are witnessing before us today a revolution that seems similar to the development of the printing press in the 15th and 16th centuries. Just as technologies then, the people developing the printing press had no idea that how their technological developments would unleash a revolution within the religious churches of Europe, I don't think we know where we're going with this new technology. But the fact is that forgeries and disinformation can now travel more quickly, cheaply than ever before. The problem is, it seems to me, that we, in the post-truth era of alternative facts, there's a fertile ground for disinformation. The secret of the success of agencies like IRD and the USIA is that they had a clear narrative on which they could hoist their counter-narrative to Soviet propaganda. What we're seeing today, any which way you look at it, is a crisis of liberal democracy. So I'm not really sure what these agencies, what is the narrative today. So I'm not a particularly pessimistic person, but it does seem to me that we are living in pessimistic times. I think I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Dr. Walton. We have about 15 minutes for questions. If you could state your name, affiliation, and ask a question. Please refrain from the temptation to give a lengthy speech. We'll take questions in groups of three, and we have a microphone, I believe, right? So if you want to call out three people,
Back, middle, and then, yeah, back again.
Thank you. Hello, I'm David Smith of The Guardian. I just wondered, is there also a long history of not only election interference, but someone within the country holding the election actually colluding
okay.
with the foreign aggressor, whether a particular candidate or a political party, and have you reached any of your own conclusions about whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russia?
Yeah. Can I answer that one straight? Is that before I forget? Or, I think I'll answer that one. Collusion today, let's wait for Robert Mueller's report. There do seem to be some strange developments, you know, meetings that were going on that were forgotten about and then remembered. It doesn't look good. But as a historian and I guess as a barrister, I'd like to stick with the facts. So we'll come to these kind of conclusions. I mean, I'm itching for 30 years down the line when the records come out. And I should have said in the talk, I think I'm right in saying that there's going to be a further release of JFK files tomorrow, the next day, sometime this week. So then we'll be able to revisit a lot of what I talked about what the KGB was developing in terms of the assassination. So today's collusion, don't know. But it's a really interesting question, and I hadn't thought about it before, but there's an Oviev letter in 1924. There was, I think it's safe to say, collusion on the part of either MI5 or SIS in leaking the forged letter. There were people within MI5, certainly, that were closely, or just they just left MI5 and went off to work for the Conservative Party, and it suited their purposes very well. There's no smoking gun, if you like, that I've been able to find. I point you in the direction of, as I said, the paper written by Jill Bennett on exactly this. And so that's an interesting parallel, but a lot like what we read about today. I don't think there's any firm evidence showing there was definitely collusion. But great question, thank you. Was there a question up the front? Yeah.
Hello, Cynthia Eford. I'm the president of the Association for Public Diplomacy Professionals and 35-year veteran of the USIA.
Thank you for coming.
I agree that we need to look more at information and covert actions throughout the historic period. But I think that we have to look at it to see how often they regularly failed.
How often who?
Covert measures. Regularly failed, and
yes.
I think it's very easy
yeah.
to say post hoc propter hoc,
yeah.
And also because, as any bureaucratic organization, when they evaluate their own work,
yeah.
they find amazing success.
Yes.
And it would seem to me that what was proved in the middle of the Cold War, and what I think we will find in the next few years, is that covert actions, because they underline their own credibility, inevitably are less successful than, as USIA did, openly attributed, intelligent work. And by sort of melding these things together, I think that we can come up with false policy recommendations.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd love to carry on the conversation with you afterwards, because the USIA is certainly that something that I'm just beginning to research. I know a lot more about the IRD, and to your point, IRD was always, from the outset, very, very clear that they wouldn't produce false information in order to counter Soviet information. It had to be grounded, rooted in reality, in the let's use the term, the truth, because it would just be, as you said, a spectacular own goal if there were, if it was discovered that actually this counter-information agency was also producing fake news. But I don't, I mean, James Clapper said that what we need today is something, in his own phrase, USIA on steroids. But it isn't clear to me, as I was trying to say in a very glass half empty kind of way, what is the narrative today with such a crisis in the US and in other governments? What is our message at the moment? And I don't know what that is. So yeah, but thank you for the comment. Question at the back.
Thank you, Larry Garber. So I wanna, the title of the presentation, I'm not sure you're responsible for, was The History of Foreign Interference in Elections, and yet you only talked about the covert side of that effort. And I think one of the challenges that we face, and clearly in this country, we moved post-1970s, you can attribute it to whomever you want, Reagan perhaps,
yeah.
To overt interference in elections. We didn't call it interference in elections, we called it democracy promotion.
Yes.
And the challenge that we have today, and I come from the democracy promotion world, so I'm not trying to criticize, but the challenge we have today is distinguishing between what is legitimate activity in support of democracy overseas and inappropriate interference in elections. And unless we can draw some clear lines, I think we're going to run into the challenge going on. Clearly, Putin believes that what we did in his elections, 2011, was also inappropriate interference in those elections. Mm-hmm. And I think we need a narrative that justifies the democracy promotion activities without then also creating a false equivalence between that and the covert action.
Yeah, well, can I respond to that right now? It seems to me that if the subject that we're talking about is interference in elections, actually overt and covert are two sides of the same coin, that the aim might be the same, to interfere, promote democracy from the Western perspective in another country. It's the means to which you do that. And the quote that I put up about the Italian election from the Church Committee made exactly that point, that if this were done to conduct an operation in Italy openly, it would have been counterproductive. So I think I understand what you're saying, but...
Yeah. That's the point. We move from that perspective of the post-Cold War, that you have to do these things covertly.
Right.
What Reagan and others argued, which is that you can do overt democracy promotion to counter authoritarian regime or whatever, and that was legitimate.
But I don't think, it depends on when you say we, who are we? I don't think the CIA and the Directorate of Operations would have ever given up their plans to carry out covert actions in countries that posed a threat to the US. So I get what you mean, but I see that there are different roads getting to the same trying to policymakers or agencies trying to get to the same goal. Does that?
So again, I mean that may be the case, but certainly those who work in the overt side don't acknowledge.
Oh no, sorry. If that was the assumption, then absolutely not. No, far from it. I would imagine so. Question at the back.
Hi, Robert Condon. I'm just a tourist. Can I ask how much, question on resources or budgets, how much more is the US, Russia spending or less than
today?
They were in the Cold War? Yeah.
Oh, that's a really good question. And again, I wish I knew. The Russian intelligence services today are not the most transparent of agencies. So there aren't budgets in that way. And actually, the history of US and British intelligence, still, the funding is one of the most sensitive subjects in the historical records. The secret vote in the UK about how to fund the intelligence agency, that's still always blacked out in the documents. But the example I gave you that and I'm just working from information in the public domain on the Internet Research Agency, the building that I put the picture up of, it's a staggering small operation in terms of funds, a couple million a year, you know, however many computers and people sitting around in shifts trolling social accounts. That's just one, obviously just one example. But I think that's my conclusion is that social media and our interconnection today, you know, you can get your news on your watch now if you want. It allows for a much cheaper way to do this than it has than in the past. That would be my gut reaction, although I don't have figures for you, Rob, I'm afraid.
Thank you.
Question at the front.
Yes, Edward Lozansky, American University in Moscow. Can you tell us a little bit, if you did some research on U.S. interference in 1996 elections in Russia with Boris Yeltsin, both covered and overt?
No, I can't. I don't really know very much about that, I'm afraid. But there are, I know Tim Gottnash in Oxford is getting interested in that subject, so I'd point you in the direction of his. But this is, I mean, as we were talking just now, this is how Putin would view it. You know, what he's saying is there's a logic to it. But maybe you'd be able to tell us more about that lies outside my field of expertise. Maybe we can carry on the conversation afterwards. Sorry, I can't answer your question more comprehensively. Question here.
Ken Meyercourt, TV producer. If I understood you correctly, regarding that British document that was declassified.
Yes.
You said that was unusual.
Yeah, very unusual.
How can you write, it seems like lot of the most important information concerning intelligence is secret.
Yeah.
As I understand it, the British are still keeping secret certain documents related to the sinking of the Lusitania.
That's right.
100 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but yeah, I get your broader point, yeah.
So are you a little insecure that if you had access to these things? You mentioned the secret budget. We have one black ops here in our budget as well.
Yeah.
It's like I don't know whether you're familiar with the Saturday Night Live skit, the old one with Gilda Radner, where she plays this person who's got strong beliefs, and then the anchor man points out a fact to her that and she says, sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
Might that be the case if we really had access to all these secret documents?
Definitely. Well, very briefly, I mean, our picture's incomplete about the activities, certainly on the British side at the moment and on the US side, but it's a hell of a lot better than it was 15, 20, 30 years ago. We owe a great deal of thanks to a former Director General of MI5, Stephen Lander, who is himself a historian. Who in the late 1990s decided that they would start declassifying Security Service MI5 archive because of its historical importance. And there's been an avalanche of records now in the National Archives. But you've not only got MI5, you've got records from the Joint Intelligence Committee, the overseeing assessment body of the UK intelligence community. The point I was making about MI6 is that MI6, or SIS at the moment, doesn't release records from its own archives, but there are lots of MI6 documents you can find in the files and records of other UK departments. But your broader point is, you know, how can we trust the or, you know, what to what extent are we just within the picture of the intelligence history past? Have we just got a small little smidgen of what was really going on? And we'll never know. That's the problem. You work, it isn't dissimilar, I'd argue, to medieval history, where you're working with fragmentary evidence. You know, you do the best that you can. I've written one book, I'm writing another book, and I'd be really happy if someone comes along in 10 years' time and says, no, this was completely wrong. It's a first draft of this new area of history. I'm not trying to write an authoritative history, although I hope that the Cambridge history volume will be authoritative. But I take your point, and you just need to be very careful when you're looking at the evidence. Why has this record been released? I found for more recent period interviews to be particularly helpful, particularly interviews with people where you can confront them with a document from the time where they say, no, this happened. And then you say, well, it's not what you wrote here 30 years ago. And they go, oh, well, actually, maybe. I've also found personal collection of papers in various libraries to be hugely helpful as well. It's continually surprises me, I'm happy, how much intelligence officers write in personal diaries and keep in the attic at home, and then find their way into various university libraries. So there's a gold mine of resources. I don't think you need to be overly pessimistic about the records that are released, but it's definitely a good idea to approach them with caution and try to combine weaving together different archives wherever possible.
Okay, we've reached our time limit, but